so diverse, and you see a lot of people really projecting a vision for the future.
The project is an, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
An augmented reality 3D interactive installation.
Who can be black? Who can be white? Like, has it, the words black and white, like, what does that actually mean culturally?
This festival is incredibly important, obviously, I say that. But what we do next is just as exciting.
Hello and welcome to Away, Daniel Browning with you for my last show for a while. And if you stay with me until the end of the program, I'll introduce you to the new presenter of Away. Very exciting. But today, we meet some of the emerging artists and curators who feature in Black Wave. Now, it's a keynote initiative of the 2014 Next Wave Festival, which is being held right now across Melbourne. And these artists, they've all been commissioned to create new work and they've been nurtured in the process. Black Wave is multi-art form. So we've got dance inspired by the traditions of the Torres Strait, we've got new independent theatre work, we've got a video, there's a big installation and 3D art you can view through a specially designed app on your smartphone. And there's also a publication, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers, curators and artists speaking, or writing as the case may be, for themselves and in conversation. And Black Wave fits neatly into the festival's wider premise that we're in a transition phase and that old ways of thinking and making art are about to give way to a grand new narrative. If you agree or believe that or not, there's some strong, inventive and perhaps even risky artwork being made, even in an Aboriginal context. The festival is a major undertaking, and Black Wave is just one aspect of a much wider story. Over 28 days, there are 40 world premieres and 239 local and international artists. But today, we meet the artists who put the black into Black Wave. The Next Wave Festival Director, Emily Sexton, is our guide.
Next Wave is a very special context. It is a high level of experimentation matched with some decent resources. So in that environment, when you've got this opportunity, it was important to me that we did stuff that mattered and that we really pushed ourselves to not just present, I guess, a festival of cool stuff, which I think it is, but actually a festival that was reaching and attempting something ambitious in a deep way, not in just a scale, not in just big fancy things or expensive things, but something that would change how the future of culture what the future of culture looks like in Australia. So before the 2012 festival, I sat down with my then artistic program manager, Serena Bentley, and we went, we love this festival coming up, but who's not here? Who could we work with more in and differently that would really have a lasting impact on what culture looks like? And although we've worked with some outstanding Indigenous artists over the course of Next Wave's 30-year history, but we thought it could definitely be more embedded and it could be, yeah, more representational across the organisation from a board, curatorial, staff and artist level. We tossed and turned about, so in terms of our curatorial and artistic development process, we didn't really change a lot. We went out and deliberately found outstanding artists who also had Indigenous heritage, but they went through exactly the same process as anyone else. When it came to the festival, though, we did want to say, this is here. This is important and it's special. There's a reason we call it a keynote initiative, not a project, because it's not a once-off. This is something that, you know, and in terms of it having three different forms, a book, a talk series, and these seven projects, it's really important that this has a lasting impact and that part of what we're doing is not inventing something, but actually just using this great opportunity that is Next Wave to show what's already there. And in the process, ideally, find more Indigenous artists who are ready and waiting for this kind of opportunity. So I guess in some ways the success of it is not really inside 2014, it's actually inside 2016, 18, and as we kind of continue into the future. And also what is inevitable and continuous about Next Wave, the success is not really inside our festival, it's actually in the change we see throughout the arts community more broadly. I have really big hopes for this, and I know that the artists are incredible and worth it, and the work is really good.
My name is Taji Moore. I'm a Sydney-based emerging curator and I'm co-curator of Black Wave for Next Wave Festival.
My name is Tony Albert and I am an artist currently living and working in Sydney.
I joined up with Next Wave Festival late last year and they, as you said, they approached me and told me about Black Wave and their vision for the project, and I thought it sounded amazing and I was really optimistic about it, and yeah, that's basically how I got on board. And I've mostly been involved with the publication, so that basically involved, you know, selecting people to contribute and topics for everyone to write about. So yeah, it's been an amazing process.
Taji Moore came through recommendation from Tess Ellis, who works at COFA in Sydney. And at the time, Tess said, "This woman is the future." And then when I mentioned Taji's name to Tony Albert, he said the same. And so by the time I met Taji, I was like, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen? And in fact, she is a very intelligent, quietly spoken woman who is immensely considerate and wide-thinking, broad in how she considers the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia.
One of the things being considered in the publication and I guess more broadly across the festival is this question of the future. How much are you thinking about the future of what people call Indigenous art?
I guess all the time, you know, being an emerging, someone who's, you know, emerging in the field, and, you know, what the publication, yeah, it's projecting a hopeful future and, you know, intergenerational dialogues that, you know, young artists are having with established and mid-career artists. I think it's a really important time right now. You know, we have so many people who are starting to emerge in the field, and that's something that we really wanted to capture and bring to light.
And how did you curatorially decide on this group of artists? I mean, I guess that would have been a decision that you made kind of in concert with Emily.
Yeah, it was a very collaborative thing. It involved, you know, Tony Albert as well, and we all just kind of were really looking at what was out there. A lot of the Next Wave team, they'd done a lot of research themselves, and we didn't want to just focus on visual arts. We wanted, you know, a whole cross-section of areas, you know, performance, writing, you know, all different things. So, yeah, really, you know, what's out there right now, what things we wanted to highlight. Yeah, it was really about looking at, you know, the complexity of dialogues that are, you know, being had at the moment, and yeah.
I first met Tony a couple of years ago, and as I have grown my awareness of both his practice and how he holds himself as an artist, I get more and more impressed about just the impact that he's having both in Australia and internationally. He is so collected and so sought after as an artist, and yet the generosity that he shows in a mentoring way to people like Dale Harding and actually across all of our Next Wave artists is really inspirational.
Tony, you described yourself as a bit of an imposter in this process, but you're not really, because you have a history of, you know, of supporting, you know, as you get older too, of supporting younger artists just as you were supported by certainly all your colleagues within Proper Now. So it's part of the way you work.
Absolutely, Daniel, and I mean, we've had many, many a conversation over the years. I guess I just say that when I'm sitting in an interview with someone like Taji, you know, it's just so important for her to be the person that is heard and for people to understand that, you know, the lengths in which she went to in pulling this all together. I was certainly there at some points offering ideas and suggestions and thoughts, but, you know, I just didn't want to take away off any of that limelight.
You know, a lot of ways, you know, as an Indigenous curator and, you know, Indigenous people working in the arts, we're always about, you know, educating people and correcting misperceptions that people have, and that's something that's definitely behind Black Wave, and, you know, finding a space for people to talk about things that, you know, people in the public may not necessarily have the vocabulary for yet. You know, where this is a really sort of challenging publication in a lot of ways. We have a lot of you know, dialogues taking place that aren't often, you know, had before. So,
and I think for me, looking at certainly the copy of Black Wave is the need for certain questions to be answered at this point in time, which I think is really important. What is binding through media, social networks, there is these, you know, questions that are really here and now, which I think people want not necessarily to be answered, but to be discussed. And we are at a very sophisticated time where we can sit around and throw these questions backwards and forwards to each other. No one has to be right. No one has to be wrong. It's more about a point of here and now and some important issues which are being raised.
It's so diverse. You see a lot of people really projecting a vision for the future. Yeah, it's definitely something that looks to the future and talks about how what could be done differently or what can we take from generations before us and what might, 2030 look like. Yeah, so I don't know. In a lot of ways, though, Aboriginal art has come so far over the course of, 20 or so years, and how we have curators in our mainstream institutions and things like that. It's just pushing that a little bit further. What more can we do?
Taji, was there any aspect of any of the work that kind of you thought twice about? I mean, Carly Shepherd's work is really pretty game, I mean, there's a lot of work that is challenging. Mm. And I think, art, it has to be challenging. It should even be challenging to us.
Yeah, I totally agree. You will see works that will challenge, they're very, provocative. And yeah, I think that's a great thing. I think, seeing works that, kind of push you a little bit and prompt you to think about things that you wouldn't normally think about. And I think that's something really important. And, with Carly's work, she looks a lot at identity. And, I think that's a really important kind of topic at the moment. And to talk about it like that is, it should be really interesting to see how people respond and what conversations, we'll be having, around those works.
Taji Moore, co-curator and editor of the Black Wave publication, and Tony Albert, the artist, mentor and Next Wave Advisory Committee member. And you can hear them talking in greater depth next week here on Away in a panel discussion at the Wheeler Centre with Destiny Deacon, Virginia Fraser and Clinton Nain, hosted by Richard Bell. This is Away on RN, Daniel Browning with you. Choreographer Carly Shepherd's produced a deeply personal dance work and she's called it White Face. Carly's a graduate of NAISDA, the Aboriginal and Islander Dance College, on the central coast of New South Wales. She was born in Queensland, but she grew up in Frankston on the outer edges of suburban Melbourne. And that's where she invented an alter ego, who's just discovered she's Aboriginal.
White Face is about my experiences being a fair-skinned Aboriginal woman. And it's a dance work, a contemporary dance work with theatre in it.
Carly's project White Face, and I mean, I guess in particular her character Chase, is something that people will find confronting. And I think that's what art is about. It is about asking us questions and prodding us into different kinds of areas that ask us to reconsider the way we understand the world. I think Carly's incredibly smart. She knows what she's doing. It's satire. And satire is read in different ways by different people. I think the most important thing with Carly is to get along and see that show and experience it for yourself. Preferably doing that, if you're a white person or you're an Indigenous person or whatever your cultural background is, have the conversation with those people beside you who come from a different family history, because people will respond differently to this work, and that's what makes it interesting and really important and very cutting edge.
We knew that we were Aboriginal. For me, and this is my experience, I find it very important to highlight the fact that this is my experience and not necessarily the experience of the rest of my family. Everyone experiences things differently. Yeah, I didn't really grow up knowing much or anything about what it meant to be Aboriginal. I just knew that we were, my sister had dark skin and my dad had dark skin and my brother and me were lighter and that we were Aboriginal, but I didn't know what that meant. We grew up in very, very religious surroundings in Frankston. It wasn't until my sister kind of initiated this, I know I'm different, I know I'm Aboriginal and I just, want to understand what that's about. And she decided to audition for NAISDA. She's always been an incredible dancer since we were young, so yeah, she went and studied at NASDAQ, and then a year later I followed suit. And then we kind of began our education, I suppose. Chase is like a vehicle for me to kind of splurge out all of my questions and ideas and inquiries about many taboos which are faced by a lot of Indigenous people, I think, right now in Australia. Just the whole idea of growing up fair skin and growing up in this saturation of this colonial environment with a lot of religious, fundamentalist religious input, and kind of not having no real proper education on the context of who I am as an Indigenous person. That sort of creates a lot of taboos and a lot of discomfort in you when you're kind of like, well, I am Aboriginal, but I don't know how to connect to that. And when you do, there's this feeling of sitting on the fence in both places. Like, there's this really big distinction between being a black fella and being a white fella, but you're both. So there's and not really feeling a part of either. So Chase deals a lot with that. She also deals, she's like a bit of a piss take of some of the stuff that I've kind of dealt with or am dealing with, I suppose. She's very crass and very rude and naive, and I think that that naivety and that vulnerability is what is like good about Chase. Like, people can connect with her. She's like a catharsis for me and for, I think, for a lot of people. Like, when I first was doing Chase, it was just this stand-up routine that I'd do when I was drunk at parties. I'd try her out on people just to see if, like, they could handle her with her disgusting language and her bogan, redneck boganness, and people just loved her. And then I went to Ilbidgery with this idea of writing a script around Chase, and they did there was the Black Writers Lab. And so I took part in that, and I did the intensive and ended up writing, like, just the kind of skeleton of a one-woman show, you know, on Chase. And I just wrote, like, maybe three scenes, and I performed it for the showing and went down pretty well. And it was so much fun, and I was able to just give her so much depth just by going, okay, well, what is her story, and what, how do I kind of create her as a full human being? And then she kind of went out of control, and I put her in whiteface. Just she only features this a little bit. She only features for about, you know, 5 minutes, but it's an important 5 minutes because she kind of anchors the other themes and the ideas in the work.
Do you reckon she gets a bit too much attention?
Way too much attention. I was in India and for 3 months, and then I come back and she's everywhere. She's just run amok while I was gone. I have been dealing constantly with the ethics of this in my mind. Well, before I even began the work, I suppose, just the idea of making work and the ethics of it with family, the ethics of it with many people will take Chase as an offence to their existence, which she certainly is not. She's actually a champion of everyone who feels that they can't express things that aren't really allowed to be expressed. They're not popular ideas and they're not popular realities, so she's a champion for those. I'm kind of looking in the direction of, and wanting people to look in the direction of, how much media drives our beliefs of who people are and who we are, and it's this self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's media, but that controls whole cultures, and that is incredible to me. So that's kind of what I'm talking about with the title Whiteface. It's who can be black. Who can be white? Like, has it, the words black and white, like, what does that actually mean culturally and as genetically? It's a lottery. Like, my sister has dark skin, my brother has darker skin than me, and their experiences of life in Australia are completely different to mine as a result of that, not just as a result of that, but that results in completely different experiences. I was in when I was in India, we had Holi Festival, which is a festival of colours, and you just constantly just getting covered in colours. And by the end of the day, I had this brown hue because of all of the colours mixed together. And I took a photo of all of me and my friends, and I looked brown in this photo, and I had this intense reaction to it and that I was not expecting. I was like, my automatic mental thought pattern was, that's what you'd look like if you were a real Aboriginal. Or if you had have turned out right, but instead you turned out white, you know, like it was just this weird thing. I was like, oh my God, wow, that's very interesting. And a habitual response, because it doesn't matter how much you learn and how much you know, you're just going to click back into these habitual responses that you're conditioned with, and just from it having your experiences that you've had. And I think that's really interesting.
Dancer choreographer Carly Shepherd, and she's performing White Face at the Footscray Community Arts Centre from the 6th to the 11th of May. This is Away, and you're with me, Daniel Browning. In her new film work commissioned for Black Wave, the artist Megan Cope interrogates the way Aboriginality is certified. Now, the film's called The Blacktism, and the artist is at the centre of a transformative, quasi-religious but absurdist ritual, where a host of Australian stereotypes perform a blacktism.
So Megan Cope's The Blacktism, for me, goes to the heart of a real tension that is present in quite a few of the works, where it's got this satirical edge, it's got a celebratory aspect to it that's quite empowering, but it's also deeply somber. And that's the line, I guess, that a lot of the artists are walking, where they feel they are incredible, strong, empowered people who've also are navigating a community that's been repeatedly in trauma. So The Blacktism is, you know, in and of itself a very powerful work, but there's something inside it that also is representative of a very common experience and throughout our Indigenous artists in this program, where, yeah, that you know, this tension between suffering and celebration or empowerment and struggle is a very close and very difficult line. And I think it does touch you in a very deeply held place. It is very disturbing, but also really intriguing. And I mean, that's the best of what art can do, I think.
Well, the work came about quite serendipitously, really. Prior to applying for Next Wave Festival, I had applied for a grant to undertake a residency in Paris. And during that process, I was required to get my Certificate of Aboriginality, which is something I hadn't done before or had before. So during that process, I had quite an experience, actually, which then prompted me to make this artwork. And I actually never ended up applying for that residency, because by the time the application had closed, I was already on another train of thought with this work. So it was in the very rough stages when I applied for Next Wave, but it's culminated quite well during Kickstart, which is, we've had a long time to develop it and work on it.
Now, Kickstart is where they bring you down to Melbourne, or you're actually based in Melbourne now, but you're able to, I guess, workshop the ideas with other practitioners.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, Next Wave provided a producer and also a lot of time and also financial support to develop this work to ensure it's realised, I guess, in the best way possible.
Now, that process of obtaining your certificate, what did it make you think? I mean, it's a process that can make you question yourself and in a very negative way.
Yeah, well, that's precisely what happened. I called the elders on Minjirba, and I spoke to an auntie there, and I said, oh, look, I'm applying for an application to go to Paris. And they were all very excited and said they're very proud of my work. And I said, oh, but I need the Certificate of Aboriginality. And so she went through the procedure that I had to undergo to get, you know, so you had to get a JP to sign it and then send it through, and it gets processed by the board. of elders. And in that moment, you know, being, I was thinking about being, you know, legitimately certified. And I suddenly, in that moment, said to my auntie, "Oh, do you reckon I'll get it?" And she, you know, laughed and said, "What do you mean?" And then I realised in that moment that I'd adhered to this elimination strategy that's sort of embedded in our subconscious as Aboriginal people. Like, I suddenly doubted my authenticity. I suddenly thought I wasn't Aboriginal or Aboriginal enough to get a certificate. So I guess it was that feeling and being confronted by that reality which is what led me to start unpacking and start to question also who this certificate is for and why. I mean, it is complex because the black community does issue the certificates, but at the same time, it's really interesting because we all know who each other are with family, but also professionally and in the broader community. We already have our way of validating each other's ourselves and our identity and making connections. Like, that's all deeply embedded in our history. So yeah, I found that really, really interesting, and I wanted to make a work that was sort of a metaphor for that experience.
There comes a time in the history of the Commonwealth when we must become fully reconciled to our past if we are to go forward with confidence to embrace our future in this great nation, Australia. We gather today as good citizens to witness the blacktism of Megan Cope and to commemorate her passage to becoming an authentic Aboriginal. We Australians recognise that you have been recognised by the Quandamooka people as a member of the community and therefore recognised as an Aboriginal.
One way of counteracting this kind of subterranean racism, as you so aptly described it, one way of dealing with that is through humour. I mean, Richard's done it in his, certainly in his video work, Richard Bell. But that's it's also part of the way you're working with the blacktism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm absolutely inspired by Richard Bell's videos and how he has that capacity to present these really difficult issues to talk about in that really sexy format. You know, to be honest, the whole idea of getting a certificate is quite absurd. And so I wanted the narrative and action in this video to be absurd, but then presented in a way that's completely normal.
Megan, do you accept our recognition of you as an Aboriginal person? Under the sign of the Southern Cross, forged with the might of the Union Jack, I hereby black ties you, Megan Cope, for the Commonwealth of Australia as an authentic Aborigine.
You know, and to be honest, I've always wanted the colour, same skin colour as my nana and my cousins. Like, you know, I do have a complex about that. Oh, I wish I was, but I'm not. You know, I can't help that. But I have had a similar experience to most of my family. Like, we all understand and know where we're from and where we're going, you know? So I have to get over that. And it's really interesting, you know, one of the things that happened during the blacktism was, you know, I got blacktized. I got turned into, you know, we called it, you know, the pigment resolution, where all Australians will now see me as an authentic Aborigine. Through that process, I got painted by the archetypes, the proper colour, and I got brown contact lenses in there. And, you know, they're really trying to help me be like a real Aborigine. When I saw myself in the mirror after that, I was so shocked. Because it's funny, you know, like I just said, you know, I've always envied my darker cousins and family members and wished I was like them. And then when I saw myself with the same skin colour, it was so overwhelmingly strange and unnatural. And I guess reinforced, like, that actually skin colour doesn't matter. It is your experience and it is your interaction and your responsibility to, and your commitment to your community that defines your Aboriginality, not skin colour. Like, it's very strange. You'll see it. I almost look like an anime character. It's just absurd.
Megan Cope, and you can see her film The Blacktism on the ground floor at Screen Space in Guildford Lane in the heart of Melbourne City. Daniel Browning with you. This is Away, and you're on RN.
So our theme for 2014 was this rallying call for a new grand narrative, and I think Stephen Payton's response to that is potentially one of our most interesting. He's just, you know, what he's gone back to is this moment of settlement, and which is possibly Australia's most problematic grand narrative. And he's inserting and reframing what that history really means from his own perspective, and then asking us to participate in it. It's so potent and so present. I can't wait to really see this work.
It's a project called My Bullock Modified, and it's taking a previous painting that I've done, which was an oil painting of a speared cow or bullock, and putting that into virtual space. So the project is, are you ready for this? An augmented reality 3D interactive installation. I guess one of the themes that kind of comes through in a lot of my work is that colonial conflict and me kind of trying to deal with these ideas, being a Gunai man, young man from Gippsland and Monero. It's something that I guess when you sort of hit your early to mid-20s, you kind of realise that these things happened, and it's kind of more of a personal thing of you trying to deal with these histories that people tend to omit or deny. Just in some of my research through Australian history and these Australian paintings, or so-called Australian paintings by, they were by the Swiss and the Austrian, the Russian painters, Europeans who came out to Australia and painted the landscape as European as they wanted to see it. And so it was kind of looking through and researching those paintings that I noticed there was never, ever any imagery of a cow being speared when it was such an issue at the time for the squatters. They were fearful of Aboriginal people and them kind of taking their bullocks.
You move to, I guess it's a particular spot. You have to be outside the Royal Exhibition Building in Melbourne. Why that site? I mean, through the app and, you know, through the way it's geotagged, but you've chosen that spot for a particular reason?
Yeah, I guess because I live around the area and I'm always at the Melbourne Museum and around the area, and you see that building and it's such a grand building and statement of European dominance and power. It was actually the first Parliament of Victoria.
First Parliament of Australia was held there.
And Australia, yeah. Mm. And there's a really awesome image of the local Aboriginal groups coming in and meeting with the Parliament. So, yeah, I guess it was kind of, I thought, a good backdrop to play this story out. It is an imagination as well. There's an imaginative element to it where you're kind of in the shoes of an Aboriginal man from that time and walking into the king's estate or something and taking your bullock, my bullock. So that's what the whole project is about, this kind of idea of ownership and misunderstandings of ownership. So the idea behind the app is that you do interact with it and you play out this scene. Your iPhone or smartphone becomes your woomera, and you flick your phone to flick the spear at the bullock. So there's kind of that element where I want people to be doing something and engaging in the work and being part of it. But also there's another element in there, which is when you spear the bullock, your phone will automatically save that image and that becomes a document. So we're asking people to document these histories, these new histories or old histories and retelling of these stories, and upload it to Instagram, Facebook, whatever, social media with the hashtag MyBullock. So that's the interactive part of the work.
Stephen Payton, whose interactive augmented reality 3D installation can be viewed in the vicinity of Carlton Gardens and the Melbourne Museum. And that's when you download the free app for your smartphone. Details on how to do that are on our website, abc.net.au/rn, and find Away in the program menu on the right-hand side. Well, now my next guest describes herself as an independent artist who works across the art forms. She's a storyteller, dancer, choreographer, and a musician. Here's Next Wave Festival Director, Emily Sexton.
Janelle Aguilar is absolutely one of Australia's most interesting dancers across the country at the moment. And I'm pretty excited to be presenting her first choreographic work in the festival. For both the artists who are part of Black Wave, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, but artists throughout the festival, there's been a very strong intergenerational aspect to the program, and a lot of the artists have turned to their elders to really inform the kinds of futures they want to imagine, which I think is a very hopeful and exciting thing for this year, for this country, and also for this generation. Genoa's process has been so informed by her mother and her grandmother and all her kind of fellow family out in the Torres Strait, and Melbourne's a long way from there. And I guess it's a very exciting opportunity to really educate and kind of encourage people to see this very different perspective on what Australia is about. And when it's so enriched and so kind of deeply informed by family, I think we will arrive at is a very special and intimate experience, but also very contemporary.
I was actually born in Rockhampton in Queensland, and my parents were born in the Torres Straits. But when they talk about, you know, what it was like growing up and what my ancestors were living with, you know, it always amazed me. And the thought of having no calendars at all, kind of, you know, I could not fathom what it would be like. And they said that they used to live by the four winds, and each wind would tell you, you know, when to hunt and when it was going to get cooler, because, you know, in the Torres Straits, it's so hot. I don't think they own anything thicker than a sheet. Because, it's just tropical up there. So, yeah, I was very much inspired by the four winds. There's a particular story that my mum was told when she was younger, and she told me when I was younger, and I loved it. Yeah, this work has been inspired by that. It's not the actual story at all. My mum and I and my family, like my dad and my aunties and uncles and everyone, have helped me try to find my own story, so my interpretation of my mum's translation of the story. And that's how Winds of Wolder came about.
The four winds have their own names.
Yes. Depending on which area of the Torres Strait you're from, depends on the pronunciation of it. And we're doing my mum's translation. So there's Kuki, Sager, Naigai, and Zi.
And that story that your mum told you, I understand this is an interpretation, but there are parts of that story that have to remain closed and secret.
Yes, yeah, it's not my place to tell that story. My mum could tell it, but it's not mine. So it's my interpretation of that story. My mum has helped to find a narrative of our own that is inspired by that story as well. So, yeah, it's very exciting. I can't explain how far it's actually come since my mum and I were talking about it years ago, trying to figure out how we could start putting Torres Strait stories, you know, on dance stage or theatre stage or a combination of both. I learnt traditional Torres Strait dancing as soon as I could roll out of the cot. My dad, like, had me straight away on my nappy there learning dancing and stuff. And, you know, and I was very, very, very lucky to learn all of that. And when I come out the other side, you know, now I'm like, wow, you know, thank you. And I thank my parents all the time, you know. Thank you for, you know, giving me that flogging there to make me stay at home so I did island dancing. At the time, I was a bit of a hearted. I was like, ah. But all my friends get to go and play, you know, and they're like, nah, you stay here, you learn this. And, yeah, there's so many things that I know how to do because of all of that and because I was so strong with their culture and like, how I couldn't imagine how hard it would be coming straight from the island to the mainland and having, you know, and no community around you, because at that time I think my parents were one of the only island people in Rocky when they first moved there. And so, you know, to still stay strong to your culture, to teach your kids, you know, that this is our way of life, even though there's got cars over there and, you know, we don't have salt water to go down and, you know, to go swim or anything. It's just phenomenal to be able to say, you know, how fortunate I am that I am still passing on that knowledge, you know, and I want to share that with everyone, you know, and I will only ever say what I've been taught by my parents, you know. I won't ever step out of my protocols or my boundaries with that. And, yeah, I'm very sure of myself without being too, too, you know, proud or have an ego about myself. But I know that, you know, that what I'm doing with my family stories is definitely what they want me to do as well. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
Genoa Gila. And The Winds of War is on at the Northcote Town Hall from next Tuesday to Sunday. That's the 6th to the 11th of May. This is Away and you're with me, Daniel Browning. Sean Jorvin isn't so much a person. He's definitely a man, a bearded theatrical hydra and the persona of two multidisciplinary Sydney-based artists. Their new production, Sethru, is on at the Malthouse Theatre. And it navigates the transition to manhood, but more importantly, the quest to be a good man.
Hi, I'm Colin Kinchela. I'm a Gomorrah man from northwest New South Wales.
Hi, I'm Gavin. I'm a Sydney-based writer and artist. And with Colin, we formed the artistic team, Sean Jorvin. When we met, I was writing a blog that covered arts and culture in Sydney, just my own self-generated blog. And Colin read it and decided he wanted to collaborate with me and use my writing on a more performative level, doing film and theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And that was written under the pen name Jorvin Jones. And initially I was a bit iffy about using my real name. I just didn't want to associate my family with my art or whatever. I just wanted a pseudonym. And Colin had a character that he did called Sean William Reid that was the first black president of Australia. So he's like, well, I'm going to be Sean if you're going to be Jorvin. And it just through that, it was the marriage of the two of them was Sean Jorvin.
The history of, and it's a very young history, the writing of white fellas about black fellas has always, you know, irked and, you know, disappointed and made a lot of us black fellas angry about, you know, how can you represent us this way? You don't, you know, you're writing for us. Sure, you can palm it off and say that, oh, it's just creative, you know, and we base that on.
But it's dominated the discourse.
And it's perpetuated that discourse. So we're like, well, let's write something together and fully understand where we come from both and then go together on this journey. And then with the twists and turns of our journey, we come stronger and we feel in the end it's all about giving about the strength of story, which can be shared, the strength of union can be shared, and it's a positive thing. It's a positive thing. People have always been cautious of that, you know. We've been, blackfellas have been burnt so many times about consultation, respect, right way of doing things, and our way is a very measured way because we don't want to turn on anyone's toes. But through the last 2 years, people have come around to understand that we do what Sean Jordan represents, but we've gone about it the right way.
I think the most important thing is to show respect. I mean, I'm always trying to listen and learn before making a grand statement, which I think has been a learning journey just for me as a personality, the type of personality I am. But I think with Colin and I, we're always learning from each other anyway, and that transfers to what we do artistically, and hopefully that's of some benefit to the culture. I mean, you can't really predict that sort of thing, but that's one of our aims.
What happens, I mean, in the arc of the story, there's obviously a white fella and a black fella who grow up together?
Well, I guess we wanted to do a piece that dealt with masculinity. That was our starting point. We started with the shaving ritual, and it was to do with the idea of barbershops being like a locus of men's business, a men's space, a men's sacred space, you could say.
For all men.
And then that sort of branched out into a more wider examination. And I guess it just, because of who we are and the way we're writing, it became a cross-cultural thing in exploring those characters and how they learn off each other and different views towards masculinity and initiation into manhood and social mores associated with that. So the story does follow them from childhood to adulthood, and one of them goes away and the other remains on country, and the other one eventually comes back. And that's sort of the story arc in a nutshell, without giving any spoilers away.
This whole, as I was saying before, you know, always write for something that you know and start off as a good springboard. Okay, we're men, how do we write about men, and how do we write something then, like, oh, hang on, we're from two different cultures, but what are the similarities? And then, oh, this transition into manhood, that's just something that you know, all men go through. And I think it doesn't matter what time of one's life that happens, it's a journey, and it's a very beautiful, and it should be celebrated. And then also we're finding too little sparks of what it is to be a man, the responsibility of being a man, which is across the board, you know, how to be a good man, how to exist now and be responsible in the 21st century as a man. And this key is about us finding ways of becoming men and good men, you know, and that's something shared. And then, but let's celebrate the differences, but then mesh it together. So it's a journey that we can all celebrate, and, you know, and then, but also examine what is false in becoming a man, you know, because society puts so much pressure on being a good man, but it doesn't, they give you the answer, they don't give you the map or the journey.
I think what's important overall, especially if you're a young Indigenous artist in Australia, is that you come and see the work in the festival, because we are so keen to hear from the next generation of Indigenous artists, of all artists. But it's really important that you're getting out and supporting your peers and understanding what it is that they've made, because if you want to be part of it next, then you need to understand the context. And as I was saying earlier, you know, the success of what we're doing here isn't just in the big crowds or the great reviews or the you know, good ticket sales that we'll get for 2014. It's actually in the depth of representation of the Indigenous community well into the future in the artistic scene and beyond, of course, because I think that the cultural leaders that we're kind of empowering in the arts have impact well beyond the arts. So I guess, you know, like, this festival is incredibly important, obviously I say that, but what we do next is just as exciting.
The director of the Next Wave Festival, Emily Sexton. We also heard from Colin Kinchela, from Gavin Walters, from Carly Shepherd, from Genoa Gila, Stephen Payton and Megan Cope. And at the very start of the program, Taji Moore and Tony Albert. There are two other artists whose work is featured and must be mentioned. Ryan Presley, an extremely hardworking and talented visual artist based up there in Brisbane, and he's created an entire space using animations, projections and a dance floor. It's on at the No Vacancy Gallery in Federation Square until the 17th of May, so go check it out. I'm a huge fan of Ryan's work. And also Sarah Jane Norman's Concerto No. 3, now a durational musical experiment featuring some failed pianists, and they're sight-reading Rachmaninoff's fearsome opus, the Concerto No. 3. That's on at the Melbourne Hall on Saturday the 10th of May. You can find out more about Black Wave and the Next Wave Festival on their website, nextwave.org.au. But there's a link on our website, abc.net.au/rn. I mentioned at the top of the show that this is my last for a while. I'm heading overseas, and now I'd like to introduce you to the journalist and broadcaster who'll be Away's new presenter. Now, her name is Rhianna Patrick. She's a colleague and a very dear friend, and she joins me in the studio now. Rhianna, welcome to Away.
Thanks, Daniel.
Now, you've been presenting our sister program over on local radio, Speaking Out, for a few years. You're a researcher on ABC TV's Message Stick. But we first met years ago and worked closely together when you were breakfast newsreader at Triple J. So you've come quite a... There's been quite a journey for you over the years, over the past 10 years.
Oh, it has. It's been a very vast journey through all the different sections, I suppose, of the ABC in that time. And at no point did I think I would go from the newsroom to even local radio to do Speaking Out. So being able to do Away is something that I had never thought would happen at any stage.
Now, you're a familiar voice to me, very familiar. But tell those people, tell our audience where you come from and how you came to be sitting where you are right now across that desk from me.
Well, I was born in Brisbane, grew up in Weipa in the Gulf of Carpentaria on the western side of Cape York. Then when I was 10, my family moved back to Brisbane, and I've only just returned to Brisbane after about a decade away working in Sydney, and I spent some time in the Mackay newsroom not long after my news and current affairs cadetship. So it's been an interesting journey so far, and about 12 years with the ABC.
I can look forward to hearing your sparkling tones on the radio. The program couldn't be left in any more experienced or capable hands, I don't think. Welcome and best of luck.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and enjoy your time off.
Rhianna Patrick, the new presenter of Away here on RN, and you can catch Rhianna on air next week, Saturday 6 p.m. and Monday night at 9. I just want to say thank you to Away executive producer Lorena Allam for all her support and guidance over the years, and of course to my Darwin-based co-producer Rico Adrin. Wish you both all the best. And I'd like to say thank you to everyone who's given of their time to join me here on the show over the years, especially to you for listening. You're the reason we do this. It's goodbye from me. I'll catch you again sometime in the future.